My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at Western Kentucky University, I coordinate this series with my colleague Peggy Wright, and with assistance from our website guru Hai Wong Wan, and Brian Carson, our reference coordinator. Jason is our technical specialist tonight. Our speaker tonight is a music graduate of Clark University and received his MA in folklore and mythology from UCLA. His academic interests are wide-ranging and include publications on fiddling and fiddle tunes, bluegrass music, music of the Civil War, Irish traditional music, early country music, and the history of music publishing. He recently served as curator of the exhibit From Studios to Stages, Images of the American Music Makers, and is editing a volume on American fiddle tunes for the series Music of the United States of America, and writing a chapter on Irish American music for an anthology on American regional and ethnic music traditions. He's a past president of the Society for American Popular Music. He plays American, Canadian, and Irish traditional music on fiddle, flute, guitar, mandolin, and banjo. In 1985, he founded the Center for Popular Music at Middle Tennessee State University and has served as its director ever since. It's recognized as one of the 16 centers of excellence at universities in the Tennessee Board of Regents system. It's our pleasure to welcome Paul Wells to talk about the work of the center in collecting and preserving popular music. Paul.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming out tonight on a less than wonderful night. It's a pleasure to come up here and share some of our work at the Center for Popular Music with the rest of you up here. I'm not really a stranger to Bowling Green or Western Kentucky necessarily. We have a very good old close friend and colleague in Erica Brady, who directs is one of the professors of the Folk Studies program here, and our relationship goes back to graduate school, and certainly a lot of the things that we learned together in graduate school have informed my work at the center, which we'll be talking about a little bit as we go along tonight. As Brian said, we are one of the centers of excellence in the Tennessee Board of Regents system. This is a somewhat pretentious name, but it was a program that former Governor Lamar Alexander instituted in the early to mid-1980s to try to build research centers at the different campuses at all the public universities within Tennessee, both the UT system and the Board of Regents system. As a way of trying to build the research profiles of these institutions, many of which, like MTSU, are traditionally teaching institutions. And we are about the only archive in the system. We're started at MTSU because of a longstanding interest in popular music studies and country music writing, and MTSU has a very large and active music business program. So there's a lot of connections there that a number of people at MTSU decided back in the early 80s to propose one of these centers and focus it on popular music research and have it be an archive. So I actually was not involved in the planning, but I was the first and still the only director and have enjoyed being there for the last 20 years. I just want to thank one of our assistants at the center, Ms. Lacey Stockham, for a lot of help in designing and helping me assemble this PowerPoint presentation. So our mission at the center is to foster research and scholarship in American popular music and promote an awareness and appreciation of America's diverse musical culture. I think first and foremost what we do is run the archive, and we'll be talking about that. That will be the focus of my remarks tonight. But we take a broad view of what popular music is, in both historically and in terms of styles of music, and we'll be talking more about that. So the main thing that we do is run this research library and archive. We have a fairly nice reading room in the Mass Communication Building at MTSU. We serve students, we serve faculty, we serve visiting researchers, we serve journalists and media producers. And I'll be talking more about our collections as we go along. But we also get involved in public programs of various sorts. We do publications. We're going to have a couple of those. This is a bibliography of songsters, a form of songbook popular in the mid-19th century. We've done some exhibits, and as Brian said, we just recently did one of photographs. This was one we did several years ago of Tennessee, the products of the Tennessee music business, not focusing on music from Tennessee as such, but it is the product. kind of beyond, or Music Row and beyond, Music Row and Memphis and beyond. Those are, of course, the two most famous cities in Tennessee for the music business. But there's a lot of activities going on in the hinterlands, in the smaller towns and cities, and we wanted to focus on those. And a few several years ago, we did this Civil War music CD set for Time Life. That was a combination of scholarship and record production and performance. It's the kind of thing we really like to do a lot, where we could take things from the archive, take music from the collection, and bring it into modern performance and bring it to life in that way. We also do a lot of lectures. We have a Kentuckian lectures and concerts and symposia and all other sorts of public programs. Kentuckian there, Mr. Eddie Pennington, who we'll be talking about a little bit more lately. We present a pretty broad range of music. Our programs really reflect the breadth of our collecting interests, too, and our view of American popular music. We've housed with Ladysmith Black Mambazo, a very fine South African group. In a combination symposium and concert looking at both African and African-American vocal music traditions. We do historical programs occasionally. Sarah Childress Polk, the wife of President James K. Polk, was a Murfreesboro person, a Murfreesboro girl, and a couple of years ago was the 200th anniversary of her birth, and we worked with the Polk Home in Columbia, Tennessee. They own a music manuscript that Sarah compiled when she was a teenager. It was sort of the iPod of the day, putting together this manuscript book of her favorite songs. And so we brought some of those to life through concert and with a lecture. And we've done programs on Cajun music and on Irish music and on the folk music revival. And Mike Seeger, probably many of you are familiar with him, came a couple of years ago, and did a very nice program for us. So we try to cover a lot of different things. You know, so we started, and I guess something I should say is that we started the research collection there from scratch. I mean, I literally walked into my first day of work to nothing. And there was an empty office. There was not a chair. There was not a table. There was not a telephone. There was not anything. And there was not a research collection by any means. So everything that we've done in the last 20 years. And where do you start? You have to have some kind of underpinning to it. You can't just say, well, I'm going to get everything, which is what we'd like to do. But you kind of have to have some framework, some intellectual framework to what you do in building a collection like this. So, and this kind of evolved. I didn't walk in the first day with this kind of concept in mind, but it's kind of evolved in my own head as in the process of building the collection over the years. That really to realize that if you're going to study music, popular music, you have to look at it through time. You have to look at it in the context with other forms of music, because musicians don't exist in little pigeonholes. They steal from guitar players steal from banjo players, and country musicians steal from rock and rollers, and everybody steals from the blues and all that. So you have to look at everything in context with the other kinds of music that are going on at the same time. And you also have to look at it in context of society, and also very important are, not to be dismissed, are the commercial and technological factors that shape the music. Things like the 3-minute song is a product of the phonograph record era. You know, if you look at 19th century songs, they went on for 10, 15, 20 verses sometimes. Probably a full performance would have taken 20 minutes or half an hour. By the time the phonograph record came along, people were limited to 3 minutes, and you had to say what you were going to say within that 3 minutes. So that really had a huge shaping influence on popular music. So the point is that you have to look at technological factors. Of course, once the LP came along and was more popular in the 60s, all of a sudden things opened up again, and now pretty much the sky's the limit when we're in a media-less environment. The scope of the collection, if we could, we would get everything. You know, the most ideal popular music archive in the world would have one copy of everything that was issued. Nobody does that, not even the Library of Congress, and it's not possible. But we do like to try to make our collection representative. We like to look at both sacred and secular forms of popular music. The sacred forms are things like gospel music. There's Christian rap these days. In the 19th century, it was shake note music. There's usually some kind of music with a sacred theme that takes its musical vocabulary from what's going on in the secular musical world at the same time. So that goes back to what I was saying about having to look at types of music in context with other things that they exist with. We take a pretty deep historical look, too. We have materials from the 18th century, and this surprises a lot of people. They think popular music began with whoever their favorite was, you know, the Beatles or Frank Sinatra or Elvis Presley or Stephen Foster or whatever. But we look at music as an aspect of culture, music as a commodity that was sold, turned into a consumer item, and enjoyed in some capacity. So we really take as our beginnings, our hypothetical beginnings, the introductions of European and African peoples to North America. Even though the business didn't really kick in until a good bit later. The first music business as such in this country were the guys in New England in the 18th century who were primarily hymn writers and singing school masters. And they were writers, they were book publishers, they were teachers, and they were some of the first professional musicians in this country, or quasi-professional, and some of the first people who really tried to make their living through music in some fashion. The secular music business in this country didn't really kick in until after until the federal era, about the 1790s or so. But anyway, so before that time, what you have are materials that were imported over here, largely from Britain. Within the collection, we kind of look at things in three broad categories. We have the reference collection of books about music. This is just a bookstore bought inside a library with just the music section expanded. You know, all sorts of things. You know, we have the critical works, the historical works, biographies, discographies, a lot of reference works. Then we have the original materials, the sound recordings, the sheet music, the music commodified in different forms. And then there were manuscript collections, the unique items, people's personal papers, and whatnot. The reference collection, this exists in our reading room. It's an open collection. It's not a circulating collection, but it's open for all researchers to browse the shelves. It's about 10,000 volumes, not quite. We like to think this is probably one of the most complete and comprehensive libraries of books on popular music that you can find anywhere, with the possible exception of the Library of Congress or New York Public Library, some of the truly big public libraries in the country. As I said, this is, you know, historical and critical works, a lot of biographies, a lot of genre histories, a lot of discographies. We put a lot of emphasis on reference works. A discography, if that's an alien term to you, that's to records as a bibliography is to books. It's a listing of records in some capacity. Discographies can be by label, by artist, by instrument, by genre, by time period, all sorts of different ways you can look at them. Of course, we have a lot of serials, any encyclopedias and whatnot, and we do try to cover pretty much all genres of music with our reference collection, and we have a big focus on music industry guides, music industry publications. A lot of the traffic through our front door are students enrolled in the music business program, the recording industry program at MTSU. So we put a lot of focus on that. Then on the getting into the special collections items, as I said, music fixed and sold in some fashion. That is kind of our defining characteristic of what constitutes popular music. It's music as music created to be sold, music with some kind of commercial impetus behind it. This has taken a lot of different forms over the years. Of course, prior to Thomas Edison, it was all print. We have print in a couple of different forms. You can either buy songs singly in sheet music or other forms, or you could buy multiple songs together in a songbook, a song folio, or a songster. And of course, recordings form a very large portion of our collections, and we have things from cylinders to compact discs. And I'm not quite sure what people and other sound archives are going to do now that we're moving into the realm where, as I said, there is getting to be a media-less distribution. You know, I guess we're just going to be trying to archive everything on large hard drives. Our sheet music collection is probably the largest in the South as far as we know, although the major collections in the country tend to reside in the Northeast and in California. But we've built this, as I said, in the last 20 years. So some of the highlights of this, quite a few pieces of pre-Civil War era sheet music. Kenneth Goldstein, some names that might be familiar to some of you, a prominent folklorist, passed away about 10 years ago now. He was at Penn for 3 years, University of Pennsylvania for many years. He was, in addition to being a scholar, he was an inveterate collector, an accumulator of things, and he acquired these great collections of song broadsides, which we'll be talking more about in a minute. They're kind of they're single sheets, and they have no music notation on them. It's text only. We'll be talking more about them in a bit, and also songsters, which are little songbooks. Other things that we have in our collection are Confederate era imprints. Now, most of the music publishing in this country in the 19th century was centered in the Northeast. Once the Civil War broke out and the South seceded, a lot of lines of trade were cut off, so industries popped up down here that did not previously exist, including music publishing. Confederate imprints tended to be done on poor quality paper, printed in not terribly large quantities. So they're very rare, they're very highly collectible, highly desirable today. We have a decent collection of them, not a great. We put a lot of emphasis on Tennessee imprints too, because of where we are, particularly the pre-Music Row stuff. And we have quite a lot of show and motion picture music too. Getting into the multiple song formats, songbooks, about 7,500 of these, many of them pre-1950. The newer things reside in our reading room. The older antiquarian materials reside in our stacks area and are accessible by staff only. Again, getting back to the, you know, what did people in America do for music before there was really much of a music publishing industry here? They imported a lot. So we have a large collection of 18th century British imprints, which, you know, some of it was stuff that clearly was popular here and was sold here. Some of it were things that people might have brought with them, you know, at least in their musical memory, if not in hard form. Kenneth Goldstein, again, in addition to his broadsides, he had a large collection of songsters. These are little pocket songbooks, again, usually without printed music. It was just the lyrics. These were, again, cheaply printed and sold, and again, very desirable today. Very interesting to a lot of popular music historians, particularly folklorists, because these were the types of things that sold to people kind of low down on the social and economic ladder, not the people that had a piano in their parlor to play. So they provide a window into the taste of some of the more interesting elements of society, and a lot of oral tradition gets into these. We have a very large collection of, getting back to the business of focusing a lot on religious popular music. We have a very nice collection of gospel songbooks and hymnals going back into the 18th century, but primarily 19th and early 20th century gospel songbooks. Maybe some of you, your natives, grew up with the singing tradition of the James D. Bond, Stamps Baxter, those sorts of little songbooks. We'll be looking at a few more of those lately. We have a pretty nice collection of those. Then personality folios, you know, Hank Williams' greatest hits, or you know, the Everly Brothers' greatest hits, and that kind of stuff. And then instrumental tutors is a pretty important aspect of what we have. People nowadays are very interested in the history of guitar playing and the history of banjo playing, and one of the ways you can get at information about historic techniques of those is by going to the 19th century instruction manuals for these. Teach yourself how to play the banjo, teach yourself how to play the guitar, and on into more recent things as well. Sound recordings. We've got somewhere around 160,000 now. Again, it's from cylinders to compact discs. A lot of commercial, the bulk of our collection is commercial releases, but we do have a lot of unique manuscript recordings, field recordings. We have done a fair amount of our own recording projects. We don't have a formalized oral history program, but we've done quite a few interviews over the years, and I hope to get into more of that, particularly as the public history program at MTSU kicks into gear. This probably puts us within the top 10 in terms of size of audio archives in the country, perhaps in the top 5. Nobody really keeps careful counts of these things, but again, they form a very large portion of our collection, although I realize tonight I'm going to be talking more about print media. We are in a bookstore, after all, and I am presented here by a library, so we're going to be talking more about print things than sound recordings. Other sorts of things that we have... In addition to the music in various forms, are all the other sorts of materials that you need to help make sense of the music. You know, a songbook by itself, or a piece of sheet music by itself, is an item. It's a text, and you need to put that in context. So there's, you know, music exists in performance. So we have a lot of what we call performance documents, posters, playbills, things you get at a performance when you go there. Trade catalogs, photographs, personal papers, and manuscripts. Hello, Dr. Brady. These sorts of things exist in lots of different forms. They've been published since time immemorial, as people would say. We do have a nice collection of the Hatch show print sort of thing from the 20th century, but I chose more older things here to illustrate. A lot of documents come from the blackface minstrel tradition. We do have a lot of posters from Nashville area clubs. We're trying to collect more, get more aggressive about documenting our local music scene. There's a lot of music, live music going on in Murfreesboro all the time. I think every recording industry student has a band, or two or three of them. So we're trying to get a little bit more aggressive about that. We have a nice program going on. It's interrupted temporarily, but one of the students there got very interested in the local hip-hop music scene, has been doing a lot of interviews and taking photographs and documenting that scene. But he temporarily has gone off to New Zealand chasing a love interest, but he will be back. Photographs of... Moving on. Photographs. You know, photographs are remarkably good documents for helping us understand music, even though they're just, you know, you can't hear the music, but they really do a lot to, they provide information of various sorts to music historians. This filler over here, you probably can't read it there, but this is from Knoxville, Tennessee. Jesse McReynolds, from the famous duo Jim and Jesse, longtime members of the Grand Ole Opry. Jesse continues, his brother Jim passed away a few years ago. This is an unknown family from Sonora, California. We don't know much or anything about them, but it's kind of an interesting combination of instruments. You got a trumpet and a fiddle and drums. That's a band, I guess, a family band, presumably. And we just, as Brian said, we just had mounted this exhibit of photographs from our collection that included studios to stages. It included a lot of older photographs when people had to sit very stiffly in photographer studios. And getting your picture taken was a big deal. You had to go into town to do it and pay money and make an appointment and do all that. From that kind of stuff to modern stages where we can actually capture musicians in the act and capture some of their emotions and some of their expressions while they're doing it. So this was a lot of fun, and we hope to send this show on the road sometime soon. Other thing, trade catalogs. Trade catalogs are a very, very good source of information about a lot of things in music. In the history of music, record catalogs are part and parcel of the work of a lot of music historians, combing through old catalogs and seeing what was issued and when. Printed music, obviously. Instruments, old instrument catalogs are very interesting for tracking different changes in construction of instruments over the years. And old instrument catalogs actually are extremely expensive on the market these days. There's a high demand for them. And they go for multiple hundreds of dollars when they come up. And of course, you want to track the ways that people enjoyed music in their own home, the playback, from the Edison phonograph days to the iPod, all the different ways that people are able to consume recorded music. Manuscript materials, unique items. This ranges from personal papers to actual manuscript music. I mentioned a bit ago Sarah Polk's manuscript music book. We have quite a few other manuscript music books like that that are unique documents of their time. This man here is Brad McEwen, who worked for many, many years for RCA, and then he founded his own label, Mega Records. Their big hit was Help Me Make It Through the Night by Sammy Smith. But Brad was an old-time jazz fan and jazz lover. As I said, produced a lot of original sessions himself, but also was very responsible for and the guiding force behind a very important early reissue series on Victor, the RCA Vintage series that came about in the late 60s and early 70s, and really served as one of my introductions to the world of older recordings. Brad passed away 3 or 4 years ago, and a few years before he did, he approached us about acquiring his personal collection, his personal papers. So we are just, it was a monumental task to pack all this stuff up and bring it down, and processing the papers has killed off more than one archivist at the center. But we are in the final throes of getting that complete, and we'll do something about making a deal of it when it is complete. Diaries and things like that make very good primary source documents for the study of music history. I'll talk a little bit here about the relationship between folk and popular music, partly because that really that relationship really informs a lot of the way I've, my background as a folklorist has really informed a lot of the way I've developed the center. And it's really what where my background is. I came at this with a long-standing interest in country music, early country music, bluegrass, old-time music, and all those sorts of things that kind of have always existed on the borderline between community-based oral traditions and mass-marketed commercial musics. And actually, my background in understanding this and appreciating this is really has its roots in many ways here in Bowling Green with D.K. Wilgus, who was the predecessor of the people in the Folk Studies program now, who was teacher for many of us, went on, and some of who came back. But D.K. was a pioneer, really, in understanding that there was this relationship between oral traditions and commercial traditions. And as I said, this has really informed a lot of the way I have developed the center, that we need to understand folk music in order to fully understand a lot of what genres of popular music and vice versa. If you look at pretty much any kind of popular music that came out of the South in the 20th century, whether it's ragtime or blues or jazz or country music or rock and roll, pretty much there's this relationship between the community, oral traditions, non-commercial, and the mass market traditions. And even to the hip-hop of today, you get that kind of tension going on. So I think this is, we don't, as I said, we can't draw harsh lines between, you know, the world of folk music and the world of popular music, and you really have to look at it as constant interplay. Talk a little bit more about that, get back to the song Broadsides that I mentioned earlier. These are a couple of examples. As you can see, very cheaply printed. These were the kind of things that were sold for a penny or a couple of pennies at the time when sheet music was being sold for $1 or $2. Much cheaper to produce than printed music was and engraved music, sold by news dealers and news sellers rather than music stores for the most part. And as I said, you know, these provide, they were kind of the 78 RPM records of their day, in that they act as a conduit between folk tradition and popular tradition. You get things like an old traditional ballad here. This is would be known to ballad scholars as James Harris or the Demon Lover, and actually was anthologized by the great Professor Child. Turning up here in print in the 19th century from New York, and sold on street corners, presumably, and dating back to, 18th century Scotland, 17th century Scotland, something like that. So you get the older traditional material getting put onto broadsides and sold back to people, and then you get things like this, the wild ash deer. Probably had its origins in the commercial realm in some fashion. You can't really read the text from there, but that forms the basis of Uncle Dave Macon's song, The Cumberland Mountain Deer Race, which Uncle Dave Macon, who was one of the early stars of the Grand Ole Opry and resident of Murfreesboro, Tennessee, recorded in the late 1930s, and it was again popularized through the folk revival circuits largely by Pete Seeger and various people. But here's Uncle Dave is a very interesting character. I've been spending a lot of time listening to his music lately, and so much of his repertoire is a real combination of songs from oral tradition and an awful lot of stuff that can be traced to broadsides or songsters or sheet music. He really does sit right in the crossroads between commercial music and regional folk music. Sheet music is another form in which this nexus sort of can exist. This song, Are You From Dixie, had its origins in Tin Pan Alley, but it was picked up and it was one of the signature songs of one of Kentucky's favorite sons, Grandpa Jones. It was one of his theme songs for many years. So you have Tin Pan Alley songs going into folk tradition. You have fiddle tunes going from folk tradition onto the printed page sometimes and then going back into oral tradition. Ragtime probably began as some sort of oral tradition. Things got published, printed, and formalized by Scott Joplin and cohorts, and then turned back into an oral tradition of ragtime. And blackface minstrelsy is one of the first manifestations of professional entertainers taking things they heard black folks singing and professionalizing them and putting them on the stage. Going from there. Sound recordings also exist as this kind of conduit between the traditions. This particular song here was at the heart of a very important and very complex legal case in the 1920s that has taken half a book to really unravel it. It was the train wreck occurred in Virginia in the early 20th century. There were local songs written about it. Then when the hillbilly music industry came along, people started recording them. This guy, Vernon Dalhart, who was a professional singer, originally from Texas, but made his name in New York, I believe, recorded it, and the big hit was what was on the other side, but all of a sudden here was a song making a lot of money, selling a lot of copies, and people who wrote the original song felt that they had been their work was overlooked. They were assumed to have been a song in oral tradition with unknown author. Well, that was not exactly true. So it was the genesis of one of the first lawsuits over recorded music, because where there's money to be made, people will come out of the woodwork. Religious traditions, you know, are they folk traditions? Are they popular traditions? Are they something else entirely? But we look at them pretty carefully. We have a lot of things like these are the old four-shape note songbooks from the 19th century on into 20th century African-American songbooks. Here's a white gospel quartet from Arkansas, the Hartford Quartet from Western Arkansas. Some of you may have heard the Fairfield Four, one of Nashville's premier African-American a cappella gospel singers, stalwarts of a style that had its heyday in the 1940s and 50s that's still going on today. So these are all things that we look at and collect. Again, back to manuscript collections, in addition to things like personal papers and music executives, field recordings, a lot of projects that we generate ourselves. We've recorded things like the Tennessee Banjo Institute, which happened in the late 80s and early 1990s. And again, back to the early tuning manuscripts. That gentleman there was Bill Harrison, who was one of the founders of the big Athens, Alabama, Tennessee Valley Old Time Fiddlers contests, starting in the early 1970s. And when Bill passed away, his family donated his papers and photographs and whatnot to the center, and it forms a nice documentation of that contest down there. Okay, now, that's sort of the overview of what we do, and now we're going to get local about it. And I do apologize that I had prepared some audio examples to go with a few of these songs, but technology did us in for some reason. The laptop doesn't like my jump drive, and the CD doesn't, the audio files. I tried for 2 hours this afternoon to get it to work, and it didn't. So anyway, I thought we'd look at a few songs about the great state of Kentucky. This is probably one of the earliest ones that builds off of the image of Kentucky, called The Hunters of Kentucky, published in Philadelphia around 1824, 1826, depending on your source. But it remained popular for a long time. This sheet music is from about the mid-1820s, 1826 or so. But this remained popular into the 1850s and 1860s, and was published again in broadside form. You know, see, there's quite a difference between this and that in terms of a printing artifact. In fact, we'll go and look a little more closely at the headpiece, partly because it's such a nice bit of example of the engraver's art, but also it's interesting to me, and maybe to some of you, that the image of the Kentuckian at the time. This is the kind of thing that was sung in character on stage. Mr. Petrie and his fellow professional entertainers would dress up like this. Now, whether this garb has any relationship to what people in Hunters in Kentucky were actually wearing at the time, I don't know. Maybe it did. But you know, the drawing on the Kentucky rifle, the image of that, and drawing on the backwoods image, the rough and rowdy pioneer. The song itself is about the Battle of New Orleans, and about how these backwoods Kentuckians stood up to old John Bull and showed him what for. It was picked up as a campaign song by Andrew Jackson's forces in the later 1820s and popularized through that route. This is often seen as a real typical song of Jacksonian America when the Democratic uneducated people rose to the fore and kind of took over things. There was a fairly famous story about this song being sung by an entertainer named Saul Smith, who was a professional stage entertainer in the 1820s. He made it one of the hits of his live shows, and he got on stage somewhere, I forget just where, in the north, and went to sing it and suddenly blanked out and couldn't remember what the words were, which happens to entertainers all the time. And the audience prompted him. They knew what they were. I mean, that happens at Bruce Springsteen concerts, and it happened back then too. The song was so popular, they wanted to hear it. They knew it. They knew it completely by heart, but they wanted to hear him sing it, so they had to prompt him with the words. Here's your stage song. This is again in broadside form from Stephen Foster. I don't need to tell you any of you about that. And that Kentucky rag is. I can't tell you anything about that because I don't know. The writer, Hampton Durand, the composer, doesn't turn up in any of the basic ragtime works that I consulted, nor could I find out anything about the rag, but you know, ragtime was a popular movement in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, so there were lots and lots of rags written about all sorts of different topics. And you can see again here the imagery that they draw on for the cover. Horse racing in Kentucky, and you know, the white gentleman here shooting off a pistol and going on that. I don't know that that's ever been recorded. Don't know anything about what it's like, but it's you know, a lot of this that I'm doing now in this part is just sort of rummaging through our closet to find sort of interesting Kentucky items that maybe are new to you. We seem to have sort of enduring themes and song titles. You've got your Blue Kentucky Moon by Walter Donaldson, and then you've got your Blue Moon of Kentucky by Bill Monroe. A much more famous song than Blue Kentucky Moon, and I kind of doubt that Bill Monroe knew anything at all about Blue Kentucky Moon. Walter Donaldson made somewhat of a career of writing songs about states that he probably never went to. A lot of Tennessee songs written by him, and a lot of Kentucky songs, a lot of other places in the South. There was this real vogue at one time for in the early 20th century for writing you know, songs about places that the writer may or may not have ever been to. And more enduring themes, and again, many of you may know Bill Monroe's song, and Going Back to Old Kentucky. Well, he wasn't the first person to use that title. And in spite of the little wish down here that this guy would like to be remembered in the same way that Will S. Hayes and Stephen Collins Foster are, I don't think anybody much remembers these days W.C. Pyatt, the courier boy. But anyway, I found a surprising number of songs that... by the titles that Bill Monroe had used, and other people had used the title before. Monroe had a pretty powerful song called On the Old Kentucky Shore, recorded in the early 1950s. And again, this is one that nobody really knows much of anything about. Now, this is an interesting one here. Pearl Bryan, there were a number of songs written about Pearl Bryan. She was a very famous murder victim in the late 19th century. In February of 1896, a decapitated body of a woman was found near Fort Thomas, Kentucky, up near Cincinnati, up near Covington. And it took a long time for the police to be able to identify who it was, and it turned out to be a woman named Pearl Bryan, who was from Greencastle, Indiana, which is a little ways away from there. But she was dating a guy named Scott Jackson, who was a dental student in Cincinnati at the time. He was ultimately arrested, and along with his roommate, tried and convicted and executed for her murder. I believe that her head was never found. She was decapitated, and I believe her head was never found. But you didn't think any of that lay behind that very bucolic-looking sheet music cover there. But this is a later printing. It's 1935, and the songs that were sort of popular about it were all from the 1920s. But the song in there is one that was recorded by by Vernon Dalhart, who we saw a few moments ago with the record of the old 97. But I just was really struck by the contrast of this nice bucolic image and the fact that it's about a murdered girl, for crying out loud. Now we get into songs that were music that was printed here in Kentucky. As I mentioned a moment ago, much of the 19th century music publishing business was centered in the Northeast. Boston, Philadelphia, and New York were the primary centers. Baltimore, there was quite a bit. Then when you got further south, it was really centered along the Ohio River. Cincinnati and Louisville were the places New Orleans had an industry, but really in other places, Atlanta and Nashville, not so much. Louisville was home to a lot of different publishers, starting in the 1830s, 1832, as far as I can tell, and on through the 19th century. This here happens to be about the earliest piece of Kentucky imprint sheet music that I could identify in our collection. Presumably, the Danville refers to Danville, Kentucky, although I'm not sure of that. W.C. Peters was a big music mogul in his day. He had companies in Louisville, but also in Cincinnati, and I believe a couple other cities as well. And the Banjo Polka, another Louisville imprint from the house of D.P. Falls, who was another one of the big, he was perhaps the biggest Louisville publisher in the 19th century. And again, you get some nice graphics there and images of the banjo. Sacred music publishing in Kentucky. I mentioned a moment ago about our gospel songbook collection. In Tennessee, there was a very, very important gospel songbook publisher called James D. Vaughan, began right around the turn of the 20th century, based first in Lawrenceburg, Tennessee, and then moved over to Cleveland. That company continues today as part of a small publishing conglomerate owned by, I think it's the Church of Christ. But he's someone who, you know, a fair amount is known about. I'm not aware that people have really researched and gotten into the Kentucky publishers all that much. We just have a few by this one publisher, the Pickett Publishing Company, again based in Louisville. I just throw these out as a topic that, you know, I think is probably in need of research by some diligent student somewhere. I suspect they were probably a pretty active company, but if research has been done about them, I'm not aware of it. Another little Louisville item, from Covington this time, the Guide Publishing Company. We have only a few items by them, but judging by the ads in the back of their book, they were ready to produce these in lots of different editions for whatever your purpose may have been, Sunday school or church or whatnot. I should go back up to say the Pickett Company, like a lot of gospel songbook publishers, would sell you a book in either round notes or shape notes, and you had to specify which you wanted and which you're most comfortable singing from. Kentucky artists, probably the only people pretty familiar to many of you, the great Western Kentucky guitar player, songwriter, singer, cartoonist, Merle Travis from Muhlenberg County, Grandpa Jones, longtime staple of radio and the Hee Haw Show in the latter years, and passed away a few years ago. Everly Brothers, again, Muhlenberg County folks, friends and family of the families of Travis and Everly knew each other, and they are still honored in these days. It was, when I grew up, I knew them as rock and rollers, and it was a little bit of a revelation to me to realize that they did have some country roots in them, pretty strong country roots. Bradley Kincaid, another very popular Kentucky artist who actually toured up into my home country of New England for a lot with Grandpa Jones, very popular up there, sold scads and scads of songbooks over the radio. He had a dozen or 15 different ones that he was quite happy to sell you, and provided a big share of his living for a long time. I was very surprised to see the Hunters of Kentucky pop up, that 1820 song pop up again in a Bradley Kincaid songbook. He had a very, very eclectic repertoire. It ranged from sentimental songs to traditional ballads to things like this that he would dig out of somewhere. So I guess I really shouldn't be surprised based on what I knew of his eclecticism. Bluegrass music. Bluegrass is, after all, one of the dominant symbols of the state, and is the bluegrass state. This, you can't read it here, this is the Pride of the Bluegrass, a Leica drum corps from Lexington, Kentucky. We actually had this up in our exhibit with a little question mark. Was this the earliest bluegrass band? I'm not sure that anybody got the joke. But. And then over here, you know, amid the bluegrass of Kentucky, does that depict any real scene in Kentucky? Probably not. It was probably the work of a Chicago artist. The song was written by Charles K. Harris, who was, his big hit was a song called After the Ball, which lived on for many, many years. He also wrote a song called Mid the Green Fields of Virginia, which had certain currency as well. So I think he was another one who was in the business of writing songs about states the man and I had ever been to. But then we have the real thing, Bill Monroe, again from Western Kentucky, out in Racine. I was surprised and delighted when I started digging out items from our collection earlier this week to discover this one, the songbook, autographed by everybody in the band. Monroe himself, Bill Monroe, this is the back cover of the songbook over here. Bob Hicks, who was his fiddle player for many years, but could also play banjo. Over here is Charlie Klein, who was with Monroe for many years. Again, something of a utility man, could play fiddle and banjo and guitar. At the time, probably was playing guitar. Joe Stewart here was probably playing banjo at the time, but again, could play fiddle and guitar and bass. Joe Stewart is known as the only person who recorded on every instrument other than mandolin with Bill Monroe, I believe. This is Vassar Clemens, who just passed away a couple of years ago, very popular as a fiddle player. Bessie Lee would be Bessie Lee Malden, who was Bill's longtime consort and bass player, and sang harmonies in the. I don't think she ever recorded officially singing. She played, recorded a lot playing bass. I don't think she ever, her vocals were ever recorded, but there do exist some radio shows of her singing solos. So this was something she did on their live shows. I don't know who Hank Davis or Eddie Dyer were, and the experts I've consulted, the names didn't mean anything to them. But this band recorded in 1955, and I speculate that because a lot of these people put WSM after their names, that this may have been signed after an operative term or something of the sort. Moving on to the great tradition of Kentucky guitar playing. Merle Travis, as I said, was known primarily as a guitar player. He inherited a tradition from Ike Everly, father of the Everly brothers, and there's a long lineage of people before him. And the lineage that continues today with people like Eddie Pennington and all sorts of other folks. I don't know when this began, and people have been poking around into the origins of this, and I'm not saying that any of this really relates to the history of that particular guitar style, but I was kind of surprised to see how much guitar-related sheet music we had published in Kentucky from the 19th century. This was for the parlor guitar tradition. It was fairly common in the 19th century to publish works, publish popular songs arranged for piano. That was sort of the default. Probably 90% of all things that were put out were published with piano arrangements. The other 10% was guitar. And I was surprised to find how much guitar music from Kentucky that we have. We have something like not quite 500 pre-1900 Kentucky sheet music imprints in our collection. And almost 14% of those are guitar arrangements. So guitars were available here in Kentucky, and music for guitars was available at least as early as the 1840s. This piece here was the earliest piece of guitar music from Kentucky that I could identify in our collection, and it's from, I believe, 1842, something like that. I didn't write the date in any place where I can actually read it. It was actually sold in a music shop in Nashville. So in the Ohio River Valley and down onto into the Cumberland Valley, there were people buying guitars, playing guitars. There was a demand for the music. There must have been a demand for the instruments. So we know that guitars were in this area of the South by that time. This particular piece here is more interesting to modern guitar players. It's one that got into folk tradition a lot. There's been any number of guitarists, both black and white, who have recorded Spanish Fandango, learned probably through oral tradition, not from sheet music. But for guitar players in the audience, if we have any, very interesting here is that they indicate the tuning, and this is tuned to an open G chord, which is the way all the folk players play it. They tune it to an open G and go from there. And again, I had a nice recording of this, which I'm unable to play for you. But it was kind of a revelation to me to realize that there was some sheet music published. This is from 1854 with these open tunings indicated. So this was something that may have originated in folk tradition and got picked up by the commercial publishers or may have gone the other way. And continuing in the same vein, guitar method books. This was one published primarily in New York City by William Hall, who was a big New York publisher, but it carries the imprint of Louisville, of DP Falls here. So again, not only music, but instruction books were available in this region in the mid-19th century. And here are some of today's, well, not today's, but 20th century's masters. We get Rebecca Merle Travis here in a very strangely colored piece of sheet music. Eddie Pennington, we saw this picture before. This is a man named Tom Owen who lives down near Chattanooga. This is at a concert that we produced at the Center 12 years ago, I think, now, which was well, the first time I ever met Eddie. And these guys, backstage before the concert, they just got their guitars out and they just started playing, and that's what these guys do when they get together. They just get their guitars out and just nonstop guitar music. Odell Martin, who passed away some years ago, this was an album assembled from home recordings. I believe he didn't do studio recordings. And this is here also because the center was involved in producing this issue. We do, and among other things, we have an audio restoration lab, and our former staff member, Bruce Nimrov, did the remastering for that. We worked with Bobby Anderson and Eddie Pennington quite a bit on some of their projects. So that's the great traditional Kentucky guitar playing, which many of you probably are familiar with, and if you're not, you can find out about it pretty easily by just heading west from here. Back to the center to wrap things up here. So we have all this stuff. Who gets to use it and how and when and why? We're open to all researchers. It is a non-circulating collection. It is primarily a research archive rather than just a drop-in listening center. But if anybody is doing research of one sort or another, whether it's a class project or a book or a radio show or whatnot, they're welcome to use our collection. We've had school kids come in. We are open during the week. Appointments are not needed. If you are looking to do in-depth research on something and spend some time with us, it's advisable to let us know ahead of time that you're going to come down and what your needs might be. All the collections, of course, are non-circulating, and on reproduction, we abide by copyright laws, and sometimes condition will preclude making a copy of something, but it doesn't mean you can't look at it. You can search our collections by going to our website. We are in the midst of getting our website completely redesigned, so it won't look like that, I hope, in another month or so. The easiest way to get there is just go to the university's homepage and then follow the link to libraries, and there'll be a sublink for the center. That's the direct one if anybody's interested. And then once you get there to our homepage, to the center's homepage, you can follow the link to special collections and search different databases by medium. Whether sheet music or rare books. Now, I have to say, our sound recordings are the one item, one big chunk of our collection that are not cataloged at this point. So there are other ways to get at that, to get at sound recordings, and they pretty much require staff help for that. But we're happy to answer inquiries if need be. In terms of making our collections available more broadly, we've just wrapped up a project that was funded by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities to digitize our broadsides. These are little things that lend themselves pretty easily to digitization because they're just one piece, and you can just scan them fairly easily and add the image to the catalog record, and in the process of doing that, we also enhanced our catalog records. They're now uploaded into the National Bibliographic Database, OCLC. We're working on a website through our own homepage that will allow you to see all the images and print them off yourself, but that's still, we're still tweaking that, we're still fooling around with that. Again, back to the reproduction issue, we do respect the copyright law. Copying of anything that's still under copyright protection can be done for, under the provisions of the fair use, under the terms of the fair use provision of the Copyright Act, which pretty much covers anything related to research and teaching, but it doesn't allow us to make copies just for personal use and turn ourselves into our own Napster or anything like that. Some things that we do require fees for time and labor, and if things people want to use things in publication, there's usually use fees for that as well. And that's about it. That's sort of, like I said, a quick overview of what we do, some of what we have, and rummaging through the Kentucky corner of our closet. So I'm happy to answer any questions. Yes, please.
In your minstrel collection for reasons. First of all, it is no longer allowed to, we're no longer allowed to produce or whatever the Blackbeard minstrel. But I wondered if your collection is large and if it is used and if anybody ever really asks about it.
There's actually a lot of interest in that these days in the part of academics. There's been a lot of research and a lot of papers, particularly in musicological circles about 19th century minstrelsy, And images and issues of race and all that stuff. It's a pretty fertile area of interest. Our collection gets used a fair amount. We have materials that go on into the 20th century. You know, certainly when I was growing up in rural New England, there were still blackface minstrel shows being done at the time, until about 1960, 61 or so. So we have, and every community was doing these. We have lots and lots of pictures of, you know, 20th century, you know, community minstrel troops, you know, people on the stage in the local grammar school or the high school or whatnot, all in blackface, and a lot of programs from these sorts of things. So yeah, there's a lot of interest in it. You know, the collection, it doesn't get used perhaps as much as it might, but, you know, we get called on as staff to go talk to different classes sometimes about it, whether it's an American music class. There was a class in American culture, I think, that one of my staff members went and showed some of the things and talked about some of the issues involved. Yeah. Yeah,
what kind of special problems do preserving recordings differ from the print to the...
Well, pretty much everything lives in one stack area with, you know, constant temperature and humidity as close as we can do that, and, you know, the physical needs are pretty similar. You kind of find a common denominator that of humidity and temperature that works well for everything. Things like, you know, the 78s and the LPs, the disc recordings, they last, you know, unless you drop them and break them. They're going to be around for a while. The digital media, nobody's quite sure about. You know, I have found instances of commercial CDs kind of breaking up after a few years. Not a huge problem. I've had a lot of trouble with homemade CDRs breaking up. Cylinders, it's a physical problem for the most part. There's a lot of things like mold that can grow on cylinders. You know, we clean things. You can clean things. You know, there's a lot of different challenges. The real challenge that Sound Archives face now is what to do about the things that you have to copy, the original recordings. For years and years and years, the default archival storage medium for sound recordings has been quarter-inch analog tape. Those days are about to disappear because the tape won't be made much anymore and the machines won't be, although parts will still be around for a long time. Pardon?
Actually, that's not true. We are remaking analog tape.
There's one company now that is making it, but eventually it's probably not going to be there.
What about 8-inch real deal recordings? I know when I was touring the Kentucky Museum, I noticed stacks and stacks of these pretty valuable stuff. How does it hold up?
It depends on when it was done. There was a period of time beginning in the 1970s, not into the 80s, where a lot of tape is now cursed with what's called sticky shed syndrome, where the material starts to fall apart, and you play it through once, and the stuff backing flakes off on the tape heads. You know, apart from that, there's no problem. you know, older tapes. This is an issue, and we archives have done things like bake tapes to play them through one time. We've never had to get into that. We didn't inherit, and still have not yet inherited, large quantities of material on 7-inch reels. It's not something we've had to face.
What would you consider be a preservative treatment for these things?
In the first case, do no harm. It's sort of getting around to saying that, you know, what we're on the brink of is getting into all digital storage. You know, digital mass storage. You know, some of the larger libraries in the world are getting into this more than we are. And that's an issue that we're just beginning to deal with ourselves there, where what you would have to do would be to probably bake the tape or use some other measure to try to get one play out of it and transfer it to another medium. I mean, that's the deal. Transfer it to another medium. Up until now, that has been like another tape copy, but now it's going to have to be probably a digital thing. So.
One more question. Sure. You know, with so many of the old-time studios, especially in the Nashville area, have closed or been swallowed up, has there been any attempt to try and collect some of the histories of these studios? Or
not that I'm aware of in any kind of systematic basis. Maybe the Country Music Foundation is doing something, but I tend to think not, probably. But, you know, certainly some of the old-timers like Owen Bradley and people of that generation have been interviewed. One of the more recent ones, I really don't know. I don't know. They should be, but it's, you know, a matter of time and manpower and all that stuff. Good stuff.
I'm interested in how the center went about collecting these materials.
Well, all different ways. I just started putting my feelers out as soon as I could. Some things have come from other institutions, some have come from dealers, some have come from donations, some have come from private collectors. There is no one way that we have done it. You know, we have people who come around once a month or every 6 weeks with records for us to look at to buy. We've gotten a lot from some of the student assistants in the past who are very ardent collectors, and they helped us find things. There's no one way. It's a combination of donation and purchase and dealers and individuals and scrounging, eBay sometimes.
What do you all do, and I'm asking with personal interest in mind, what do you all do with memorabilia that's offered to you? Do you scan it? Do you take it in the collection physically, or...?
Things like scrapbooks and whatnot?
Scrapbooks, posters from performances.
We take it.
We'd
love to have it.
Okay.
We'd love to have it. We've never really had offers or gotten into, you know, copying things and returning the originals to the owners. I wouldn't be opposed to that necessarily, but no, we keep all that. That's all. That falls into the category of the other materials that you have to put everything in context. We have some. I really like to get scrapbooks of working musicians. We have quite a few of them.
Personal
scrapbooks. People who you know, sidemen in big bands, who kept programs and photographs of their performances, and you know, cocktail napkins sometimes of the clubs where they played. In a couple of cases, we've gotten things like that in that have been in very bad physical shape. In fact, we got in a very interesting scrapbook from a 19th century minstrel banjo player, which was just an absolute treasure trove of information. He had contracts in there, he had reviews, he had, I don't think he had any photographs, but he had letters, all sorts of things. And this was just in terrible shape, and what we had to do, not me personally, but my staff, took pictures of every page as it existed then, and then disassembled, took all everything off the pages because they were in such bad physical shape, and kind of reassembled them in acid-free notebooks. But we have the photographs to show us what the original was like, so that we kind of reconstructed it as best we could in a modern form. But we love to get things like that. We have some really nice scrapbooks. We have some things from a guy named Gordon Henderson, who was a West Coast band leader who did some of the first music for motion pictures. First Mickey Mouse cartoon. He had the music for that. We've got a really nice scrapbook of him, again, of his, you know, souvenirs of his performances, letters, contracts, all that kind of stuff. So we love that kind of stuff. Yeah?
Do you get support from the Is it all based from the university, or so there's been no interest in the recording industry to work with you to help preserve some of this history?
By and large, the music industry is interested in today and tomorrow, but not interested in yesterday. So I've never made any kind of serious push. You know, my colleagues in the recording industry do work with folks at labels now, but by and large, they're not much interested in heritage and history. They're interested in the next hit. And I know from, well, I think the Country Music Foundation placed in Nashville has had limited success in trying to get, you know, monetary support from that industry.
Do you collect other things like musical instruments, clothing of a former player?
No artifacts.
No artifacts.
We're not a museum. You know. There's a pretty clear distinction there in my mind between an archive and a museum. Places like the Country Music Foundation have both. They have both a museum where people can come in, and I bet that probably 95% of the people who walk through the door have no concept that there's a very fine library and sound recording archive there as well. You know, they're there to see Elvis's Cadillac and the Ray Charles exhibit and all sorts of things. It's a different audience, you know. It's we're not a tourist attraction. It's a library. Well, thank you, Franco, for coming.
Well, I want to thank you on behalf of WCU Library. It's been our pleasure to have you here, and Ms. Wright's up with a gift on our behalf to...